Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, a life among the trees, one forester's story. Polish songs of home in the heart of Limerick City. And just when you think everything has been done and nothing is new, we have a world first, a film review recorded in a calf shed. Which is exactly how we're going to ease you first into this morning. As they went about feeding the calves on the farm, Hannah Quinn Mulligan and her granny had plenty to talk about. You see, they had gone to the movies to see That They May Face the Rising Sun, a new, already acclaimed film based on the novel by John McGahern, which was inspired by his own farming life and that of his neighbours in County Leitrim.
You know, the rain comes down, the sun shines, grass grows, children grow old and die. That's the holy all of it. We all know it full well, but can't even whisper it.
That's the holy all of us. John O'Lehan playing the Shah in That They May Face the Rising Sun. So, how did Hannah and her grandmother Catherine get on?
Good morning, Bambino. How are you? Good boy. Who's a lovely calf? You going to take your bottle? Good boy. Morning, Gran.
Morning, Hannah. How's our little baby this morning?
He's fine. He's a little bit fussy, but he's all right.
Oh, good. That's good. That's good.
Are you still thinking about the film last night? That They May Face the Rising Sun. So it was a book written by John McGahern.
I could watch it again. I want to watch it again. Today, say, or tomorrow, soon. There was so much in it. It was amazing.
To give a brief recap, so there is a couple, maybe in their late 30s, early 40s, Joe and Kate, and he's Irish. He's returning kind of back to sort of his roots. She's not Irish. And he's a novelist. She co-owns a gallery back in London, and they come back for this ideal kind of simple living that they have in their heads. And then the story is about them living in their cottage in rural Leitrim, them farming, them doing all sorts of things, and the locals around them and how they interact with them. But it's so much more than that. It's so much more. You start to see the fabric of rural life in a way that you don't think about it.
Yes. Well, it was very true to life then.
So there's a wedding and there's a wake. Yes. But I guess when they initially come back to Leitrim, everyone is sceptical of them coming back and how long they're going to last. I mean, but you must have had something similar when you came back home after you'd lived in London for, 30-odd years and come back to Ireland.
Yes, and it happened. Actually, I had some friends who came back to Ireland and lasted 2 or 3 years and returned to England. It made me think, and I've always remembered it, I thought, what transition? There's no transition. I'm home. This is what I sort of planned. Just the fact that it took nearly 30 years is, for various reasons, that's what happened to people.
I guess something that I was aware of as well when I worked in London was that there were a lot of older Irish people who were in nursing homes who'd never managed to go back to Ireland for one reason or another, whether it was financial or social, or it was just too difficult. And that, I guess, the character Johnny for both of us kind of struck a chord, because he was working over in London in these quite menial sounding, even nasty, grubby kind of jobs.
Yes.
And then coming back and pretending that
everything was fine. Yes.
It put me that it had, I had, there was this kind of line of poetry going through my head, and I can't even remember if it was in Irish or English, but it was basically that, you know, this man, and he's coming home in his new suit and his new car back from London to Mayo, and thinking about seeing his family and the pride on their faces when he sees this new car and him in the suit that he tucks the rental documents of the car even further into his inside pocket. Like na cálpe sí in a fólca. And it was that sense of shame that they hadn't made it, but they were away, but they wanted to put on a good face. Like, there's so much in that, isn't there?
There is, really. And that happened in reality so much. And I think, you know, in the film, they showed, you know, they very sensitively showed the situation as it was, you know, with the from the point of view of the reality of, yes, some people did well, but the majority didn't do that well, really. They had menial jobs. They would come home once a year. Some never came home, never ever came home. And they would come home once a year and sometimes borrow the money even to put on a show, to go to the local pub and drinks on the house and that type of thing.
The other character as well, there's so much talk about in the film. So for a film that you thought was going to be a quiet film, there was so much going on emotionally.
There was so much in that film. There was.
And it would have been so easy to overdo. You know, because when people represent rural Ireland, they usually make it so twee.
Twee, yes.
That's the problem.
And this was so practical, you know, mowing the meadow. And, you know, it was so beautifully done and so naturally done. You know, even the loading of the sheep was just so natural in a normal sort of everyday box, and then the bringing in the hay, and the scene with Joe and Kate, and him throwing. They were obviously hungry.
They were hungry, and it was after the haymaking, and they were both having this big dinner, and it was late at night, and he buttered this big slice of bread, and he cut it in two, and he kind of tossed one half over to her, and kind of they just gave this look at each other, but it was really affectionate. And it was kind of, there was something in that, and kind of breaking bread together, and you know, everything was so equal in a way.
Yeah.
And another bit that I loved was, there is this Irish thing, and everyone will know it, that when you call into a farmyard or someone's yard and two men will be there talking, might be the man of the house and someone else, and someone will say, oh well, I better give herself inside a nod to put the tea on, or something like that. So this man had called in and said to Joe, oh sure, you better tell herself that we're here and she better make some sandwiches. And then Joe's inside furiously buttering bread and making sandwiches, and the man who comes in says, oh Kate, these are lovely sandwiches. And Joe and Kate just kind of look at each other, just kind of wry amusement. But it's sweet. It's sweet.
And the way they portrayed their relationship was beautiful. I thought it was so lovely. It really was. And it was not, like you said, it wasn't overdone. It was just so lovely.
There's a car coming now. We better get going with the rest of the day. Okay.
Okay. All right.
I'll see you in a bit.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Better get going with the rest of the day and not race inside and start making sandwiches. It's not just Hannah and Catherine that liked it. I just looked up the film review aggregator site, Rotten Tomatoes. 13 reviews in, it's still got a 100% rating, which I can't imagine happens that often. That They May Face the Rising Sun, based on the John McGaughan novel, directed by Pat Collins, is in cinemas, forgive me, countrywide right now. Let us talk forestry. The government's target, as you know, is to plant 8,000 hectares a year. That translates to about 300 acres a week. A large farm a week. And there are obviously any number of different obstacles to that. But one that we don't often discuss is the shortage of foresters. This is just one of the things that I want to talk about with my next guest this morning, as she steps away from her role as CEO of the Western Forestry Co-op. Marina Conway joins me from our Sligo studio. Marina, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Philip.
I love the fact, Marina, that a job that is above all guided by science, but is, I would imagine, very bureaucratic in nature now, was one that you were inspired to get into as a child because of Grizzly Adams.
Well, Yes, you're showing my age now, Philip. But
yours and mine both.
Yeah. Look, I always loved trees and woodlands. I loved the magic of them and just disappearing on paths into them. But also, yeah, watching Grizzly Adams and Beachcombers and that as a child, it just inspired this dream in me to be a forest ranger. That's what I want to do.
You wrote to Quilcha as a teenager and said, how do I become a forester?
I did, yeah. I wrote to the Forest Service at the time and said, yeah, I want to be a forester. I want to go to forestry school. How do I do that? Where do I go? What do I do? And they wrote back and told me about Ag Science Forestry in UCD, and I applied for it. And yeah, that's how I found out about it.
Had there been a little patch of woods or some special place that had inspired you at home?
I'm a coastal girl. I grew up beside the sea, which is probably even more unusual to people. But yeah, there was a little woodland, little Mearns's Valley. To me as a child, it was huge. But
In Inniscrone,
in County Sligo. So yeah, I grew up beside a lovely 3 mile beach. And always loved the land and the trees and the mountains. And Mearns's Valley, a small little hazelwood really along a river. But to me as a child, it was huge. And it was magical. Yeah, I loved it.
If we were to look at the current crop of forestry graduates, how many would there be in a year?
So at the moment, unfortunately, I think an average across is two. There's two universities that give graduates, and then also a level 6 from Ballyhays. But you have to have a level 7 or higher to be able to operate as a registered forester in Ireland. So on average at the moment, I think it's about 15 graduates a year, which isn't enough.
How many are retiring?
So recently I'm on a forestry education task force at the moment, and the replacement rate alone for foresters has been estimated at about 31 a year. And that's just the replacement rate, Philip. That's just to cover normal retirees.
Doesn't allow us to expand the industry.
It doesn't account for that target of 8,000 hectares or what's required, all the additional work that's required to deliver all the different schemes and that in forestry. It doesn't account for that, really.
We think of and we identify the choke point to afforestation as being the bureaucratic process, but how much is this shortage of actual foresters contributing to it, Marina?
Well, I guess the shortage of foresters is it's not totally contributing to the forestation, because we're not getting enough inquiries really in forestation. I guess across the country, which is probably a bigger issue and worry for everybody. But it's to manage our forests as well requires an awful lot of work as foresters too. So it's not just afforestation. But if there was plenty of afforestation inquiries, I think you'd have maybe a lot more foresters working in it. I think for foresters working in the industry, it's become people get into forestry like myself, a lot of people, because they want to be outdoors working in the woods. That's the dream. That's probably what attracts a lot of people to working in forestry. Mm-hmm. But it's become, at the moment...
Spreadsheets and forms bureaucracy.
There's a lot of time. You know, we would say to any young forester coming to us, that really it's half inside and it's half outside.
Okay, well, is that at the root of the hesitation of landowners and farmers to go down the forestry route? Because, these complaints would be relatively well justified. The ferocious amount of bureaucracy, as you're saying, the problems getting the felling licences, loss of decision-making control over the land. Are you concerned that there's a shortage of trust there between farmers and the idea of forestry?
Yeah, there's lack of information, knowledge and awareness too, Philip. It's delays and it's communication. Do you know, people, it's become so complex, really. We try to keep it as simple as possible to try and explain to a landowner what's involved. And, farmers usually generally make kind of quick decisions about how they want to manage their land. And they have lots of other schemes as well that they have to consider. So forestry, the turnaround times aren't quick enough to enable people to make decisions. And then the communication about about why, and the communication about what needs to be done, and the communication about what this involves, you know, isn't there either. And like for foresters, I guess we've become, I would say we're one of the most time poor professions out there at the moment. We're not, we don't have the time to engage as much with people as we really would want. It's become a very much a top down approach rather than bottom up. We need so much more people and boots on the ground informing, working with farmers, you know, at grassroots level, you know, in educating them and bringing them with us. And we don't, because we don't have enough people, and because it's become so bureaucratic, we don't have enough time to spend with these people. That's a deficit there, definitely.
And one of the other deficits might be a lack of trust between those who are concerned about the environment and forestry, or the idea of forestry again, because they think of monoculture, Sitka spruce, and they think of the damage to water quality and the way that we used to drain bogs and fertilise with rock phosphate and so on. Your area of research was actually in water quality and forestry. How long has it been since we have forested in that destructive model?
I suppose you're referring there to the planting of peatlands in particular, blanket bogs and that. I know that hasn't gone on for a very long time. You know, like when I'm talking about what was planted, and you know, people, I suppose when people think of monoculture and they think of big swathes of Sitka spruce, especially maybe along the western seaboard, these were virgin blanket bogs that were drained and fertilised at the time, back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, at a time when there was a very different objective and goals. It was really about economics. It was about trying to, social forestry, really, actually. It was about trying to stem the flow of emigration out of the west of Ireland and create jobs.
Did it work? To that end, I mean, whatever about the environmental damage, did it actually keep people on the land?
I did. Like, I know from talking to the foresters of the time, like in places like Mayo and Sligo and that, the local forester was one of the biggest employers. He could have a team of 50, 60 men under him, because it was all manual. You know, everything was done manual. So, and there was big areas being planted at the time. So it definitely, and it helped farmers, you know, supplement their income, and local people supplement their income. So it was a big employer, absolutely. And you know, and as well, like the objective at the time was really that is the only land that the state, and the state was the only one planting, would consider for forestry. They would not, farmland, agricultural land was not an option. You know, it was really just to be what was seen as unproductive land.
And that's the difference, is it, in the model in the co-op that you're following, where you're trying to encourage landowners not to sell up and let somebody else plant, but to plant and manage on their own land.
Yeah, so what Western Forestry Co-op has been very successful in doing, or what our whole ethos is about, is encouraging farmers to forest or plant their own land if that's the best option for them, rather than sell it. So, you know, we've been all about empowering farmers, landowners and communities, and we want to see our forests retained with our landowners, retained with our people and with our local communities, and want to see all the benefits from forestry being retained in local communities. So, and when landowners and farmers are the ones who actually get involved in forestry, I have seen that it's a much more positive result than it is when I guess, you know, a nameless, faceless investor, let's say, is the person who buys the land and establishes forests. And, you know, in my experience as well, farmers are more inclined to plant many different types of forests, and for many different types of reasons. So they will, you know, the commerciality is an aspect of it, but also recreation and biodiversity and tourism, and, you know, the many different reasons why and many different types of forests. And as well, if somebody was really upset about forestry in a certain area, they're the ones who will engage more with the local people. So it was a lot more acceptable because they were part of the community and they cared about the community. So, like, for me, I guess my passion has always been about what I call Indigenous farm forestry. It's really about keeping our forests with our landowners and farmers and empowering them to do it. And I think that's what we should be doing.
The very opposite of that monoculture Sitka spruce model that is, you know, well, three of the dirtiest words in ecological circles. Can you play devil's advocate for us for a moment? Is there anything to be said in favour of the Sitka spruce?
Oh, well, look, Sitka spruce, you know, I've said this before and people might want to send a few daggers at me now. I'll defend her all day long, Philip, because she is an amazing tree and gets such abuse. Like, it's not the tree. But it's the way it's planted and how it's managed. So, you know, when people get very animated and hate poor old Sitka, as a tree, she gives us so much. It's the backbone of the forest industry in this country. It's the backbone of the timber. And in our farms, in our businesses and in our homes, it's Sitka spruce that is in the constructions, in the fences. It's the main commercial timber that we have in this country at the moment. So it does give us so much. So I think, and look, there's opportunity and there's there for us to plant other diverse conifers and manage them maybe differently. But
love the tree, not the way it's planted, is
yeah,
what you're saying.
Absolutely. Like you know, there's no point taking it out on the tree. It's not the tree. No hatred needed for poor Sitka here. It's how we manage it and where we put it. And yeah, if you put it, you know, right up to a stream and in a bog and beside somebody's house and it shades them out, of course no one's going to like that. But you could do that if you put intensive oak all around the place as well, you know, so it'd take a lot longer maybe. But it's all about how you manage it. Absolutely. And that's what we have to, and that's what we are doing an awful lot better, in fairness. You know, they're like the days of, you know, there's a huge amount of investigation goes into any application for forestry before we plant it. So there's an awful lot of things that are considered.
You're leaving your job as CEO, but you're not leaving forestry. What are you doing?
Well, I actually don't know yet. People might find this a little bit strange, but I don't have a plan. I'm just taking some time out. You know, I've done 11 years as CEO, and during that time, you know, I've really enjoyed it. I've learned a lot.
Well, then let me ask you, as you find your next route through life and you go for a walk in a forest, pick your top two or three forests in the country.
Okay, well, as a forester, that's a really hard thing to do because I love them all. Like, I love all forests,
you're
honestly.
You're allowed a favourite. Come on.
Yeah, but I do. I mean, like, when I look back, like, I've been to places that really, you know, like, okay, so we've only a small amount of really, you know, ancient native woodlands in this country. Like, when I walk into the Oak Woods in Killarney or in Glenveagh, or if I go into Old Head Woodland, this amazing, beautiful oak woodland right down to the sand dunes in Lewisburg and Mayo, those places just completely light me up.
Old Head Woodland in Lewisburg, did you say?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And that's a coastal oak woodland, which is so rare in this country, right down onto the sand dunes, the most amazing, beautiful oak trees. So that places like that light me up. And then there's been some projects, I suppose. We did a lovely neighbourhood in Ball, County Mayo. It was 50 acres that had never been accessible. The old landlords left it to the community and it was completely choked by laurel. And we cleared all that, put in paths and opened it up. And when I go, I was there recently and walked, and oh my God, like every time I go in there, it just lights up my heart. It's
so
great.
Old Head, Ball and Killarney, am I picking the three correct ones from that list?
No. There's three suggestions. I don't have favourites, Phil.
Okay, right. No favourites.
I love all three woodlands.
Marina Conway, outgoing CEO of the Western Forestry Co-op. Thanks very much for talking to us this morning, and every continued success and happiness. We'll take a break.
Email countrywide@rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
Our next item this morning reminds me that it is this coming week, 20 years ago, we had a really, really special day in this country. The day of welcomes, when we brought in 10 new members into the EU, was something that was officially commemorated, announced to the world, if you like, at Oras an Uachtaráin in the Phoenix Park. I was lucky enough to be there reporting on it. Really kind of historical event. You saw Silvio Berlusconi and Tony Blair rubbing shoulders with Bertie Ahern and all of the prime ministers and heads of state of the 10 new members, among them, of course, Poland. And there were so many Polish people chose to come and live and work in Ireland in the years after that week 20 years ago in 2004. Some have returned to Poland, but there are 90,000 Polish citizens who continue to live here today. In Limerick, St. Michael's Church on Denmark Street is known locally as the Polish Church. And if you pass by on a spring evening, you may hear the Cantate Deo Polish Choir rehearsing in their native Polish. Dermot McIntyre of Grey Heron Media dropped in to listen to the choir and hear the reflections of the singers on their lives in Ireland.
of the songs in Polish, they are like kind of elevator that kind of brings me to those places or moments from like childhood or some memories that like we sang these songs, you know, when we were children in Poland, or let's say our parents sang it.
Alicja Rogal,
Ewa Żagdyndał,
Anna Bańko-Szumacher,
Małgosia Izabela Sawicka,
Sylwia Jankę-Krygier,
Monika Habrych.
What's the feeling that singing brings?
Is there time that you basically switch off from the daily problems or daily responsibilities?
Chwalimy Cię Wszechmocny za dary Twe
nieskończone. You work on something very hard and you can achieve a lot just by practicing and working with people together.
Tożsamość.
It's identity.
Harmonia.
Harmony.
Jedność.
Unity.
Osiągnięcie.
Accomplishment.
Ulga.
Relief.
Przynależność.
Belonging.
Where do you call home nowadays?
For people who are actually living abroad, it's a very difficult question, because when you hear you're part of this land and that's your home, but then again, Poland, it's still home as well. So you kind of divide it. I think if I even go back to Poland, my heart will stay here as well. So I'll be probably missing here as well. So like, once you move abroad, you never have one home. It's always divided. You have two homes.
Does that feel like a loss or a gain?
I'd say gain, because you're part of something different. You know, you learn a lot. Like for myself, like Ireland gave me a lot. Irish people are unbelievable. Like, you know, they're so nice, so open, so easygoing as well. And you know what? I learned a lot from Irish people to actually be easygoing, be open to other cultures, to be open to issues. Like, it changed me. It helped me to grow and to become who I am.
Like, when I came to Ireland first, I was kind of surprised that strangers were saying hi with this nice big smile. That also gives you this feeling of kind of being welcomed as well, you know?
The power of people together singing.
Dobra, to zacznijmy znowu od ciebie, od twojego tego.
I feel energized. I feel very relaxed after full day of work. Just amazing.
The guys were saying it's really, it releases stress, especially when I have a little child at home and running all day and lifting up and being with her all day. And so it's like therapeutic for me, yes. For me, and a huge amusement and entertainment.
Every time when we meet, we're trying to do so much because we enjoy it, that we just don't want this time to finish. And then straight away we're thinking, okay, when is the next time that we can meet?
Yeah, because I also think that for us, it's not only that we are just making this music and like just singing. I think we all like each other, first of all.
We do rely on each other. And even outside the choir, you know, if something happens to one person, we all gather to help each other. So it's like a family more than actually just a choir. And the reason why this is actually so strong is because we are abroad and we don't have our family here. Your friends are becoming your family that you don't have here. And I think that's why we are so connected, we are so close.
We need each other.
And we need each other, yeah. The funny thing is that most of us, when we came here, everybody was like, okay, I will be here only for a year, maybe two. I earn some money and I'll go back to Poland. And like, yet 20 years later, and I'm still here, you know? So it's like, yeah.
We are creating those situations that we speak Polish, we sing in Polish, because we know we're here, but we want to be there as well. I miss home, no matter how I love being living in Ireland, and no matter, I have my family here, so yeah, I don't need anything else, like, you know, but there is always this thing, like, you know, that I miss home. So we have to bring that part of Poland here through singing, through talking in Polish, through our Christmas traditions, Easters, and loads of different gatherings, like.
Ye are almost the first wave, that first generation. Like, everything you're doing, you're creating.
We are creating this for our children, that, because we don't know what they're going to do. Are they going to stay in Ireland, or are they going to go back to Poland, or are they going to go to a different country? But at least we know we're going to leave something for them in here. That sense of community, that sense of Polishness, that sense of our culture that they can use if they need it. I changed a lot in my own character through that choir, you know, because I was always, I wanted everything too perfect. And I understood, like, you know, that not everyone has to go the same path as I go. So I really, really changed a lot. And I learned a lot from all the people, like, you know, that sometimes I just have to step back a little bit, like, you know.
And we can learn that sometimes actually when you take this pressure off, it actually becomes much better than with this pressure.
I remember conversations we have when we first talk. Did you hear those Irish choirs? They don't look in for perfection. They just have fun. How does it happen? Because when you come back from Poland, it's very straight there. So I think this attitude came to our choir as well, and that helped us to blend. You can have fun and get to the perfection instead of just.
But that's what I learned through the years, actually, living in Ireland.
Yeah,
that kind of, well, it's going to be grand.
We're here, but we want to be there. If that isn't part of the Irish condition, I do not know what is. The voices of the Cantate Deo choir rehearsing in St. Michael's Church in Denmark Street in Limerick, brought to us there by Grey Heron Media's Dermot McIntyre. In 10 days' time, more than 80 young entrepreneurs from around the country will gather in Mullingar for the Student Enterprise Awards organised by the local enterprise offices. For each participant, this is going to mark an achievement. Their idea, their product, their business has made it to the finals. And while all the people that we're about to talk to now might be young, do not be misled by this. They have approached their enterprises with the kind of focus and serious intent that entrepreneurs of any age might need. The projects were all really wide-ranging, but there were two that caught our eye in particular as they relate to the very important issue of farm safety. I'm joined in studio by Sean Brett from County Tipperary and Danielle Hall from County Longford. Good morning to both of you. Thank you very much for coming in. Sean, we'll deal with yours first, because we're going to have a little bit of a job describing on radio what it is that you did. You were particularly worried about the slurry tank at home on the farm.
Yeah, so I come from a suckler farm in Tipperary, and my father drives a long way spreading slurry. We've rented land. So I have a little sister at home. She's only 9 years of age. I have a golden retriever dog who'd follow anything, a bird or a mouse or anything. Mm. So Dad was always extra careful, putting barrels, putting pallets, putting everything in the way to try and stop people from falling into the pit. Because when you
when he had taken the manhole of cover off to agitate or to extract or whatever.
So when you're agitating, it's fine because there's a cover. But when it's when the slurry hose is in the pit and he's gone, so there is a gap where the finger comes down against the pipe. There is a gap there where it leads a hole into the manhole.
Dogs or little sisters or anything else at peril. So you came up with an idea for a grate that has a handle on top of it that can be put onto the back of the lifter on the tractor and just placed on top of it.
Yeah, so it's a steel portable manhole cover. That's what it is. That goes into the slurry pit manhole when spreading slurry. So when the tanket is in place, the there's no way anyone can fall into the pit. It's a safety device on a farm. So you lift it in with the front loader of your tractor and it lifts into place and then it's safe.
You brought me a little plastic model prototype into studio. The top half of it, it almost looks like sort of a handbag shape as the handle can lift the grate down. And then the bottom, there's four legs which sit inside the manhole cover. So everything's nice and tight and secure. Did you do the welding on the... Because the real life version of this is how heavy?
The real life version is 75 or 80 kg, so it's heavy.
And did you learn how to weld to put this together yourself?
Yeah, so I got a lot of help now from my father and my uncle, so to help me weld, because I had no idea. Like I don't do engineering in school. I don't do anything like that. So it was trial and error, like at the start.
Well, trial and error, yeah. This is the successful prototype. Were there many that didn't work?
A lot. There was a lot that didn't work. It took a while to find the one that worked. But I have. I have now. And yeah, so I'm delighted.
Okay, well, now we come to the really impressive part, and that is the uptake. Talk to me about how many people have shown an interest in it.
Yeah, so Tankit has a huge uptake. I have a Done Deal account, which is over 2,000 views. I have a website, tankit.eu. And then I have my Instagram, tankit.thepremierfarmingway. And I posted a reel on my Instagram, which is now sitting just under a quarter of a million views with over 7,000 likes.
And do you see, folks, how many times he mentioned the product name there in the last 30 seconds? Using up every bit of advertising opportunity that he can. Danielle, your idea... it's really, really smart to take something that is a part of the backdrop of everybody's day and use it to convey a farm safety message right into the kitchen or the office or wherever. What is it? What's the idea?
So it's a 2024 farm safety calendar, and each month has different safety tips based on what's happening during the month. So February would have calving, so they'd have safety tips about calving.
I'll just open it here to the month of February, because it's not just the one tip. You take all of the kind of the top tips for the month. Have a well-designed calving pen and gate. Minimise the direct physical contact between the cow and the farmer. An innovation that we have just heard on this programme only a few weeks ago saved somebody's life. Always make sure a safe means of escape is available in the calving pen. Always wear arm-length gloves and washable protective clothing. Always have good lighting, a calving jacket and a non-slip design in the calving pen. And you have for each month something that is a kind of a timely reminder, go on, tell me about what else you have throughout the course of the year.
So for March we have slurry, which is a very important topic, and during March you'd be out doing your slurry, and when you come home or you're heading out, it'd be up in the wall, and let's say you're putting on your wellies or doing something like that, you'd look up, you'd see the tips, and hopefully you remember that for the day.
Yeah, because you have tips in there like make sure that it's well ventilated in the shed, never go back in until 30 minutes afterwards. And these are really, you know, useful things to have at the front of your mind as you go about the job. So tell me then about taking the idea from idea to actual fruition. What did that involve?
So these safety tips and the photos are from the HSA. So we got a man from the HSA, Thomas Cassidy, and he came out and he kind of gave us advice on what to put, what would be important. And I have a neighbour, he works with AXA Insurance, and he helped us. He'd be dealing with accidents on a daily basis. So he told us what would be the most important, like, because we had to get 12 tips, so we...
For 12 months
12
of the
months,
year.
Yeah. So he helped us design that.
And who's the we in this? Saoirse, Kate and Emma, how did you divide the duties between the four of you?
I kind of took the managerial role and and divided them
and
with
you delegated
the strong
everything
points.
Else,
yeah.
Did you? Okay, go on.
So Saoirse, she was communication, so dealing with people, deciding where we're going to go. So we went to marts and markets to try sell these. Mm-hmm. Emma was the financial, so she dealt with the money side of things. Kate was the designer, so she designed the layout of the calendar and got the photos which would fit. And I managed them all and set them their roles.
And what kind of feedback did you get as you were selling it? Were people impressed?
People were impressed, because with booklets you'd throw them away. You might look at them once,
you'd
throw them away,
skim
and lose
at it
them.
Once and then put it on the shelf. Absolutely,
the calendar's up all year round, and you'll see it all year round.
Okay, and how many have you managed to sell?
Around 700 of them.
That's very impressive. Yeah. That must have taken a fair bit of time, or did they fly off the shelf?
Well, it did take a bit of time. We got farming groups and selling them in the markets in the marts. So it took a bit of time, yeah.
You're not pocketing all of that yourself, though. What are you doing with it?
We're donating 10% of our profits to Embrace Farms, which is a charity that helps people who have been in farm accidents or are coping with farm deaths.
Okay. There's a bit of a tradition of inventing gadgets, Sean, in your farm. Everybody's at it, are they?
Yeah, so I think that it's on all farms around Ireland. People invent stuff just to help them out with their daily life, but it's the person who actually takes that thought and just transforms it into a business.
And does what you've done. I mean, you have a patent on this, do you?
Yeah, so Tankit is a trademarked company.
Yeah, there he goes again. Yeah, God, you're good. You're good.
Tankit is a trademarked company. I also have the design registration true. So it's safe.
All right. Well done. And look, the both of you, the very best of luck, because the final is, what, in a week and a half or something like that?
Yeah, the 9th.
All right. The very best of luck to you and to everybody else who has entered it. Very impressive stuff there. Now, it would appear that however much effort we put on this programme into finding you the most interesting people to talk to, the most interesting items to consider, there is a subset of countrywide listeners who will always say, yeah, whatever, Philip, just tell us about the corncrake. Tell us, please, when the corncrake has come back. Tell us, please, when this amazing bird has navigated its way by the stars from Africa all the way to the northwestern fringes of the country. And we have news for you from Corncrake Corner this morning on Countrywide. Here, folks, is the sound of the promise of summer. This comes from the Corncrake Life account on Twitter from the 24th of the month. Maybe there was one earlier on in the year, but this is the earliest sighting that we have heard of. Not only the sound of the promise of summer, the sound of a conservation programme that has brought farmers and communities and wildlife experts together and is doing its job. We'll play you out with Cracks Cracks, the Corncrake, this morning. Have a good weekend. Brian Lally in for Sinead Mooney on the way. Stay safe, folks. Have a good weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.